From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For decades now, Charles Bowden has been watching the lives of the border crossers from his vantage point in Tucson, Arizona. He's chronicled the harsh realities and increasingly violent culture of these border towns. His portrayals are honest and severe and don't offer any tidy conclusions about the issue of illegal immigration. Bowden says there are no honest players in this game. The people who are streaming through the borders are no longer migratory workers, he writes. They're refugees from a collapsing economy and a barbarous government, and he says their journey is biblical. Today in the program, Charles Bowden will be with us to talk about his new book. It's a collaboration with images from the photographer Julian Cardona, who will also be with us. It's called Exodus. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For years now, Charles Bowden has been writing about the surreal and violent world on the border between the U.S. and Mexico, the place where the border crossers move into another phase of their journey. Along the way, he's learned a few things about the issue of illegal immigration. Among his conclusions, the solutions that are part of the political discourse in this country, he says, are idiocy. In a new book, Bowden writes, "In the end, you don't get to pick solutions. You simply have choices. And by these choices, you'll discover who you really are." Charles Bowden's new book is a collaboration with the photographer Julian Cardona. It's called Exodus. Today in the program, they're joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join the conversation as well, if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Writer and journalist Charles Bowden is the author of many books, among them Blood Orchid and Shadow in the City. His work regularly appears in Harper's, GQ, other national publications. And Charles Bowden, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Photojournalist Julian Cardona has covered events and issues on both sides of the U.S.-Mexican border. He is based in Ciudad Juarez, and his work has been shown throughout the United States and Mexico, as well as Europe. And Julian Cardona, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
The name of the book we mentioned is Exodus, and they're going to be talking about the book later. We'll tell you about some events connected with that as we go along. Charles Bowden, I want to start with you. Talk about how this book came about. You mentioned in the book that you and Julian have been stumbling toward this book for a few years now.
Well, 7 or 8. Yeah, it's simple how it started. I got tired of listening to the lies of my government. 7 or 8 years ago, the U.S. government said about 300,000 to 400,000 Mexicans were coming north every year and illegally entering the United States. I knew of one village of 900 people on the border that was processing 600,000 to 800,000 Mexicans a year, Sasabe, Sonora. And so Julian and I went down there. He tried to move in, took photos, but that was the start. I thought something enormous is going on. And what it is, and what it was and is the largest human migration on the planet. And I have a government that's trying to pretend it's not happening. I have outraged citizens, basically where I live, turning into racists because of the magnitude of it. And so I thought, well, I'm supposed to be a reporter. I'll go out there and report what is happening. That's it.
You know, there's this parallel story that's going along in the book alongside of yours, and it's of the Mexican revolutionary leader Pancho Villa. I wanted you to talk about that relationship. You talk about in the book that the revolution of 1910 through 1920 is the religion of the Mexican state.
It's the justification. The pre-party ran Mexico for over 70 years, the longest run of a dictatorship on earth. I mean, you got to be doing something either very evil or very good to be Joe Stalin. And then the PAN took over. But the legitimacy of the Mexican state is based on being the inheritors of the revolution. Now, the revolution you mentioned killed between 1 out of 8 and 1 out of 10 Mexicans in 10 years. It expelled at least 1 million Mexicans into the United States. It had some successes, but what Villa wanted, a nation of social justice, more equitable, meaning fair, distribution of power and land and money, never happened. Now there are over 100 million Mexicans. The society, economically and socially, is breaking down. Last night in Juarez, 7 people were machine gunned. That's pretty normal now. And so we're seeing the consequence of that failure. You understand?
Yeah.
In other words, the revolution was betrayed, and now people are fleeing. And they're fleeing because they want to survive.
So you saw the relationship between the general, between Panchavilla and all of these. You say he asked the most forceful questions.
Yes, Villa has been maligned to the American people, at least if you're my age. I'm 4,000 years old now. Pancho Villa's Wallace Beery being a drunk in a Hollywood movie. In fact, Pancho Villa was a teetotaler. He didn't drink alcohol. But what he was an uneducated, brutal man of very high intelligence. And he was the most threatening figure in the revolution because he was oddly modern. He didn't want Mexico to go back to, you know, living in a cornfield. He wanted to be what we'd call petite bourgeois, small businesses, modern, we'll build railroads, all that. He was eradicated from the Mexican Revolution, meaning he was not only killed eventually, but until recently, until 1968, he wasn't recognized as a revolutionary hero. The normal explanation is he was too bloody, which is a myth. I mean, he was bloody, but they all were. The real reason, I believe, is he was too honest, that what he wanted to do was change power. And that's what a revolution is. It's a redistribution of power. I'm sorry, it's not tie-dye T-shirts in this. And actually, it's not marijuana. It's something far more fundamental. Now, there's an excellent biography of him came out about 7-8 years ago by Friedrich Katz, the University of Chicago, over 1,000 pages, which has changed the perception of him, both in Mexico and the United States. So Villa's coming back from the dead, along with the migration.
Yeah. Oh, I want to get back to that here in a moment. But I want to have you read a section from the book, if you would.
Of course.
This is on the border. You're on the line, as you say, with a radio producer. Do we need to set this up, Chuck?
Look, I'm down there with a guy. Some of your listeners probably have bumped into Scott Carrier. It's about midnight or 1 a.m. We're right on the line in Arizona. And he decides to torture me, so he records me. Okay, now I'll start reading. It'll start making sense. Huh? The tape machine comes on, and then the first question. Where are we right now? And I say, we're probably within 200 or 300 yards of the fence. It's invisible. It's like when you look overhead. There aren't any Mexican stars or American stars. It's like a great biological unity with a meat cleaver of law cutting it in half. We're in an odd circumstance. We're in a national wildlife refuge, a sanctuary, and there's 1,000 Mexicans out here scared to death and trying to make it into the United States. And there's a couple of 1,000 pounds of drugs moving around us. And there's men with AKs guarding the drugs. And there's dozens, perhaps hundreds, of Border Patrol personnel with the hairs on the back of their necks standing up all night. If you look to the north-northeast, you can see the glow of the lights of Tucson. And they're going to have to move constantly for 3 days to get there. It's 60 miles. How fast can men, women, and children in a unit travel? They can't move during the day much. After about 11 a.m., the heat will knock them down. They follow the person in front of them, and they fall a lot. And they're afraid. They're afraid of the desert at night anyway. It's a different desert when you're being hunted. They've spent their lives as human beings. They cross the wire, and they become deer, surrounded by lions. The only thing you can really hear out here are insects and fear. Hundreds of square miles just crackling with fear. Soon there'll be a fence, car barriers, then towers with cameras. These people are risking their lives tonight to cross this desert, and when they get to their Chicago or their Los Angeles or their North Carolina, they will send money back to Mexico. You take a man, you put him 300 yards south of here, and he can't find a job. He can barely feed himself. You move him across this desert, you get him to an American city. Mexico no longer has to feed him. He becomes a money pump, like a private ATM that sustains their society. Oddly enough, moving human flesh in a few years is going to be more lucrative than moving cocaine. It's the coming thing. Mexico has finally found a product that makes it money, expelling its own citizens into a foreign country. I stand in the darkness, in that pitch of night, and I realize I am tired, and I love the taste of the cold beer on my tongue. And I'm asked, well, what's the solution to this problem? And I ask, what's the problem?
You talk about...
Questions, children?
You talk about migrations occurring for thousands of years. And these images that you seem to be making this connection to this part of the world that we don't see. And there's the story you tell in the book about your trip from Chicago to Mexico in the 1950s and what you saw.
Well, look, I was a kid. I was born in 1945. And so, you know, going to Mexico was like going to Mars. It's in the early 50s. I'm riding in the back of a car. My mom and dad drive my sister and my brother and myself to Mexico. And I get down there, and the first thing I notice near Laredo is we go by a guy, and he's got no teeth. Mexican standing by the road, and I laugh. I'm, you know, 6, 7 years old. And I remember my father turning around in a rage and saying, don't you ever make fun of someone because they're poor. And of course, what I didn't understand was both my parents had been brutally poor. You know, we'd come through the best war. But before that, there was the Great Depression. Now we get into Mexico, and I'm living in Chicago in a working class neighborhood. And after the war, it wasn't like now. I remember in 1954, we got our first electric fan, the Marvel. But I get into Mexico, and I'd never seen poverty like this. You know, people hungry, people living in shacks. And I thought, why are they living this way? Why is the world this way? Now, I'm 63 years old as I speak into this microphone, and I'll tell you, I still have a mind of a child. I don't know why I'm fed and clothed and other people are sleeping outside and are hungry. I'll never understand it. But Mexico is a giant example. Look, it's the only place in the world, they say, where a first-world country rubs against a third-world country, meaning the United States and Mexico. We've had this mixed relationship since the beginning, 1846, 1848. We had a war called the Mexican War, where we functionally stole half their country. I actually don't want to give it back since I live in Arizona, but I'm not going to deny how I got the dirt by force of arms. And yet, after all this time, there's this terrible disparity in income. You know? Now, what's interesting is this went on for a long time, and yet there wasn't a mass migration of the Mexican poor here, which baffled me. If you go back to where I was talking, it's the early 50s. Yeah. Why are you staying here? Why don't you come to Chicago? We got White Castle hamburgers. You know, we got a lake. That didn't happen. This migration is something recent of this magnitude, something snapping, breaking that never broke before. And that's part of what the book's about.
I want to ask about, because I want to bring Julian Cardona in. There's an image, Chuck, I want to just sort of turn to it here, and I want you to describe this for us. And Julian, I want you to talk about it as well. It's this image of this brassiere hanging off the bushes.
Well, I'll make it simple. That's hanging off a mesquite tree, probably within 1,000 yards of the fence. And that was, a woman was raped, and that was left there as a trophy. When you cross the border, it's rough if you're a guy. If you're a woman, it's really rough because your chances of getting raped are really high. The first 3 to 5 miles, there are Mexican gangs that will take you. After that, you got to worry about the coyote who's guiding you, the guía. This is a rough passage, and that's what that is, this brassiere hanging in a tree. That is not litter. That's a boast. I took a woman here.
Julian, will you tell me about this photo first in particular, and then I want to ask you sort of generally about the images you collected.
Yes, of course. First of all, I'd like to say that this book, Exodus, is our second part of our friendship and collaboration. Right. We did a book first 10 years ago, What is the Laboratory of Our Future? And in that book, violence against women is widely exposed. It was the first work where showing what happened to people in a society that is living under the forces of the market. And now, for example, in this image, you see the same face of this situation in another part. In this case, right on the line of the U.S.-Mexico line. Mm. There are many places where a woman can be raped during her trip to the U.S. Maybe the line, maybe a stash house.
Do you... there's something kind of stark about the images, and I'm wondering about what it was you were trying to capture. That is, were you composing? Were you thinking about it? What was the story you were trying to tell or the images you were trying to capture? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, the basic thing in my work from the beginning have been I have tried to document the effect of power on people. Mm. And as Shaq said, I wanted to show, to expose the lies of my government, in my case. Officially, we live in a successful country, and it's the first case on history, according to. If we take this assumption that people are fleeing massively from a successful country, democratic, and with a good economy, and we have experiencing for years, more than 10 years now, massive exodus. And that is the official discourse of a country.
Yeah.
We are a successful country. We are doing very well. But our people is leaving us.
Chuck, I want to ask about a photo of Julian's in the book, Paula Flores. Because there's this section about women and the effect of all of this on them. I don't know. Can you describe this image?
Yes, I can. It's the face of human grief. It's the face of Mexico. Paula Flores' daughter was abducted in April of, I believe, 1998. She was 17, a devout Catholic girl, being raised in a slum, working in an American-owned factory in Juarez. Her raped and murdered body was found weeks later. That is the image of the mother at the funeral. Now, I think some of your listeners may know this photo by Dorothea Lange, kind of the Depression Madonna of the woman, you know, the woman from Oklahoma, the poor white woman with her children clustered around her. I believe in the future this is going to be the photo of that migration, of the pain of the Mexican people. Because there's something I'm sure your listeners may have thought about, but I'll make plain. There's 10 to 15 million illegal Mexicans living in the United States. They're all having children. We are going to have 30 or 40 million people that are descendants of this experience, that are part of the fabric of our society. And I think they're going to turn to that photo to find out where their parents and grandparents went to as a kind of touchstone of the passage, you know?
Yeah.
So,
Julian, you want to say something about this?
Well, basically, I'm going back to the other question you made before.
Yeah.
I said I wanted to show the effect of power. I think in those pictures, the person you see on the pictures are the ones who have the burden of our society. In some way, they are paying the price of being part of the 21st century.
I'm going to have you read another thing as we head into a break, Chuck, if you wouldn't mind. This is from page 30. This is about Claudia Gonzalez. You talk about this pattern of talk when, as you write, death walks into the house.
Yes, this is a young girl working in an American, in Maquiladora, they're called, their American-owned border plants, and whereas disappears. And then, you know, eventually the body's found, okay? There's a pattern to talk when death walks into the house, and it is not denial, and it is not despair. The men largely keep to silence. They have failed in a primal sense. Somebody has had his way with their woman. The women, at first, go to where they feel comfortable. That talent for smoothing over the rough edges of life, for making a baby stop crying, for draining the anger from their men, for keeping life on an even keel. So the women make small talk and smile, and briefly now and then mention that Claudia is dead and that this is very sad. But in the main, the women maintain so that the house can endure and so that this nebulous but very real thing we call family can exist. She was 20, with young hips promising children and a new family, with young eyes looking for someone to call a husband. She had clean white teeth and red lips and smooth skin and a fine scent. She is still here and still alive here at this moment. The bones and snatches of hair are distant reports from some cold room where strangers examine her remains. So the men are largely silent. The house purrs with the small talk of women. Everyone dotes on the small children and the younger women, those in their teens or early 20s. They simply watch. Their well-made-up eyes clear and sharp, and yet blank as television screens in lonely motels. Within hours, at the latest by early tomorrow morning, the rituals of death and burial will smooth the way for everyone. But now in this first hour, everyone is on his or her own and improvises. It will not be simple. The authorities refuse to release the body for at least 15 days, and will not conclusively state their identification of the remains until the coming Wednesday. But a major step has been taken. The family now can say the word death out loud.
Charles Bowden, he is a writer and reporter. Julian Cardone is a photojournalist. Their book is called Exodus. Tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, they're going to be at the Ken Sanders Rare Bookstore. It's Ken Sanders Rare Books for a release party and a book signing. There will also be a display of some of Cardona's images. It's part of the Salt Lake City Gallery Stroll, by the way. The event is free. To learn more, you can call the store at 521-3819 or just visit us online at KUER.org/Radio West. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Charles Bowden is with us today talking about his latest book. It's a collaboration with the photographer Julian Cardona, a portrait in words and images of the harsh realities of illegal immigration. For much of his career, Bowden has been chronicling the violent street life of Juarez, Mexico, and the lives of the border crossers. Bowden calls this migration a new strange revolution, an exodus. That's the name of the book. And Charles Bowden and Julian Cardona are in town this week. They'll be reading from the book. We'll tell you more about that as we go along. And Charles Bowden, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Scott Carrier earlier, a good friend of ours, radio producer. He talked about the way violence – I guess there's always been sort of violence, but it's changed. It's different. It's like it's almost a part of the culture on the border now, this violence.
Yes. I'll make it simple. I have spent 15 years off and on covering Ciudad Juarez, which is a city of 2 million souls. Last year was the bloodiest year in the history of Juarez, 317 or 320 murders. This year, to date, there have been over about 1,140 murders in Juarez. Now, some of your listeners are familiar with the stories about the murders of women there. This isn't what that's about. About 98% of these murders are men. Most of these murders are executions, and I'll make clear what an execution is. They take you and they put a bullet through your brain. This is not Dodge City. This is slaughter. 7 people were executed last night. But violence has become a part of the fabric of society increasingly. I think what we're seeing in Juarez is a kind of future as society breaks down, because Mexico wasn't this way. Now, I spent 8 years doing a book in the drug world down there, which was very violent, but I think now the book I wrote, Down by the River, is like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. You know, those are the nice days.
Wow. Well, one of the the demand for illegal drugs in the United States is of course growing, and this huge market has created these consequences and these refugees, tens of thousands of drug addicts on the streets, which sort of leads us into our next guest, José Antonio Galván, El Pastor. Chuck, would you introduce him to us, if you would?
Yeah, I would. I'm happy to. Originally, El Pastor was a phantom to me. I was writing a long story for GQ magazine, came out in August, on this homicide explosion in Juarez. I found this strange building in the middle of the desert outside of Juarez, full of insane people. And they came streaming over the walls. Juliana and I were there taking pictures. And to make a long story short, I said, who runs this joint? And I said, El Pastor. Mm. So then I looked him up. El Pastor has made a ministry out of the destroyed lives in Juarez, and the lives are destroyed by drugs. And what he has in his 115 people he's taking care of are the residue. He's essentially a native of Juarez. He moved there when he was a child. He spent his whole life there, basically. And for reasons that he keeps trying to explain to me, he loves Juarez.
I love it.
But he's also a man who entered the United States in the 1970s illegally, married an American, has raised children. And you got to understand how complicated this is. As we sit here having a good time, his son's in special forces in Afghanistan fighting in the United States military. So anyway, I would like your listeners to hear, instead of a guy like me, a guy who came north and did it and went back to war, as a guy who knows what it feels like to be illegal, my friend El Pastor.
El Pastor, welcome.
God bless you.
Thanks for being with us. I wanted to ask you about, you've talked about this this moment where you were driving around Juarez and you came across a man who clearly had mental illness, and you drove on.
Yeah.
But you kept getting this impression, you say, from the Lord. You were getting this revelation that you should go back and pick him up.
Well, let me tell the history. 1972, the life is very hard to be living in Mexico, especially when you are making $3 a day. We are talking about 30 pesos a day. It's very hard to, especially, you know, and I start looking at the future of my life. And I say, I can't afford it with 30 pesos, $3 a day. So the border is right across the levee right there, and I try to cross in 1972. I decide to cross the river, the border, and I start looking for a new style of the life. I tried to cross the border three times, but the three times I was rejected. I was catching by the border patrol. They kicked me back to Mexico. And so the fourth time I went to Tijuana. We're talking about 1,300 miles from Juarez. Mm. So I make it over there. Let me tell you, I was afraid, hungry, and scared because, you know, you try to change your life. You try to do something special for your son, for your family. And then I saw a dark future in Juarez or Mexico. But I can see the shiny United States across the border, beautiful houses, the people very shiny, smiling, no problem with the economy, a lot of jobs they pay you. And that time they was getting the minimum wage was $3.50 an hour. Man, I say, wow, it's nice to make $3 an hour. I'm making $3 a day, $15 a week. You know, I say, well, that is the Mexican dream. Not at all, but almost of the 90% of the Mexicans, they wish to jump the border to United States. So I reached the dream of the wetback. I crossed the border after 3 months to try and cross the border, hungry, thirsty, and afraid. But finally, I crossed the border on Tijuana, and I start my Mexican dream. I start working over there, and I start doing a lot of things, you know, to survive. But unfortunately, when you reach your dream, you start doing a job, and one thing about the people, probably they don't know it. Almost of the persons, the Mexicans or the Hispanics, we do the dirty jobs in the United States. I want to tell the people, this nation is full of people, immigrant people. The only real American people I know it, they are the Native Americans, not the Indians. That is not the name of them. They're American natives. All the rest, no matter what, they are immigrants. And then, well, I first start working on it, and I start making good money. I start making I was working from 6 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock, 9 p.m. And then I want to tell all the audience, don't be afraid to the exodus of the Mexicans. We need everyone. You know, I don't think you, brother, you can go and start picking onions or potatoes. I don't think so. For $4 or $5. I don't think so. I don't think so. You'll be right here, very in the comfort and on the cushion right there on the microphone, speaking to the people. I don't think you will be. I can see you picking my potatoes for $5. But we are here. Yeah. We need it. We need support our family. Right now, I'm glad with the Lord, because after I reached my goal, I start working, and I start doing a welder. I was a welder, a professional welder. I start working on high scrapers. I was a crane operator, and I start reaching. I was making $20 an hour. That was my problem, because I wasn't prepared to get that money. See, a wet bag working on United States from the rags to the good money. I mean, from $3 a day to $170 a day. And I make my mistake, bad mistake. I was hooked on drugs.
Yeah.
I started smoking pot, drinking, and chasing women, getting to the topless bars, and I started spending my money, and my mind started burning out. So I was so bad on drugs.
How did you go from there to where you are now?
Well,
how did you end up back in Juarez?
The between that, the gap. On the gap, I was I lost my mind, yeah. And I kicked back to Mexico. I was deported. After 1986, I was deported to Mexico again. But they deported me. I was very sick. I was insane person. When I mental problems, I lost my family. I lost my beautiful sons. I have two daughters and two sons. And in 1986, they kicked me back to Mexico. Mm-hmm. Like insane. I was walking on the streets, naked, dirty, very, very walking on the streets, eating on the trash cans. And for 2 years, almost 2 years. And then, but that happened, a miracle right there. I can see the hands of the Lord touching my life, touching my heart, my mind, and everything. And I was a person preaching on the streets, right there in Juarez, on Plaza, downtown. I was living there, on the street, like an animal, like feeling, and the people, they don't care about those persons. Who care about the crazy person? Nobody except Jesus Christ. That kind of people who born again Christian. I don't care what you believe or not, but the Lord make a miracle in my life, and my life changed in 1988 when I changed my life, and they give me a hand. They take care of me. Then I born again Christian. That is why now I recovered my family. I got two beautiful daughters. One of this is she get a degree from the University of New Mexico on economics. I got the other one is on human resources. And I got another one in New Mexico State University studying psychology. And I got my beautiful son in Afghanistan on special forces right now.
Charles Bowden, tell us about a little bit more about El Pastor's, the institution that he runs. I read 110 patients.
115. Look, here's what happened. I'll go back to the beginning. In 1998, as I recall, there was a bad snowstorm in Juarez, which doesn't happen often. After all, that's why we call it Mexico. And El Pastor was driving down the street. The streets are covered. He's about to go over a bump in the road, and a guy sits up, and it's a man buried by the snow. And he thinks, this isn't right. And I mean, he started collecting these people, these street people. Then he went out in the desert with his wife, and my God, she's a forgiving woman, with a burro on some sandy land, built a shack, and started collecting these people. Now, what he's done in the last 10 years is build an asylum. He's got 115 people there that literally no one will take care of. The state's thrown them out of hospitals. The cops have thrown them out of jails. They've been destroyed by alcohol, the barbarism of the city, paint and glue. These people, in a sense, aren't coming back. There's hardly any money for medication. You got to cook 300 to 400 meals a day, you know, and that's what his ministry's about. Now, I've been in that city a long time, and this is like a distillate, a concentration. If you think Juarez is a rough city where drugs are sold, where people are murdered, where people get low wages, when you go out there, you see the ultimate product, totally destroyed human beings. And I got to hand it to El Pastor. I'm not quite as religious as he is. He's got a drug that works. He loves these people. I've been out there with him. And here's the way it is. Imagine you're covered with lice. You're filthy. You're brain shot. You're almost tenured, you know. Nobody's touched you in years. You're so repellent. You're sleeping in your own excrement. You have to imagine with these people. You have to see them when he embraces them. It's like they get a massive jolt of antidepressants. I mean, they just calm. It's effective. One of the reasons he's traveling with me is, frankly, come to the bookstore Friday night to raise money for the asylum. Look, I don't know how to save the world. That's my next book. But I don't get out of bed and make 115 people living in misery, at least not be in pain. He does. So a tip of my scribbling hat to El Pastor.
El Pastor. José Antonio Galvani runs a shelter for the homeless in Ciudad Juarez. El Pastor, thank you very much for being with us. We're grateful.
Thank you to all your audience for this time.
Charles Bowden is with us, writer and reporter, of course, and Julian Cardona, photojournalist. The book is called Exodus. Tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, they're going to be at Ken Sanders Rare Books for a release party and a book signing. There will be a display of some of Cardona's images. It's part of the Salt Lake City Gallery Stroll. And as we said, the event is free. To learn more about it, just go to our website, KUER.org/Radio West. We're going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Charles Bowden is with us, along with the photographer Julian Cardona. They're talking about their latest book, Exodus. They're going to be reading from the book this week, on Friday, in fact, and we'll tell you more about that as we go along. Charles Bowden, I wanted to ask you about solutions. I referred to this earlier. You say that solutions in political play are idiocy. How do you think about it? Do you really think about this in terms of solutions? Because everyone's thinking about what do you do about it?
Well, I think about it the same way you think about weather. It is. I'll give you an example. American politicians like to propose work permits that'll solve the problem. Well, the U.S. government, which I don't trust all the time, admits that 500,000 Mexicans and Central Americans will cross the wire this year. They're talking about 300,000 to 400,000 work permits in these bills. There's 12 million human beings here working that are illegal. I mean, what about them? Which, you know, that isn't a solution. And the reason they offer that solution is they can go home to their districts, pretend it's a solution, and not face the magnitude of the situation. The magnitude of the situation is there's something called the global economy. Don't ask me what it is. But I've seen its footprint in Juarez and in Mexico, and it's hurling millions of people north to try and survive. And to deal with that, you have to admit the numbers. One other quick example. Everybody in this country, I travel all the time because I write for disreputable magazines to feed myself. They all say, we'll build a wall. Well, the border is 1,900 miles long. Build a wall. I don't care. Tomorrow morning it'll be roofing material in Mexico. There's no way to police the wall. You'll never find anyone in the Border Patrol that thinks the wall will solve the problem. One last solution people talk about, worker ID. Nobody can make a living here unless they have ID. Fine. All the Mexicans go home, and you get something that will make Iraq look quiet on our southern border. Their society can't absorb these people. That's why they had to leave. It'll explode. So what I'm telling your listeners is not to be in favor of illegal immigration or to be against it, but to face the fact that this is like a force of nature. It isn't that you get to say, no, I don't like those people, build a wall. That won't work. You have to deal with the root cause, the collapse of a society that's our neighbor. Is that simple enough? Because I'm a simple guy, Doug.
You are a simple guy. Julian Cardona, how are you seeing it?
Huh?
How are you seeing this question of solutions and trying to find the answer?
Well, I'd like you to answer this because it's not just Mexico. In fact, you are in the middle of a big struggle. And the forces that are playing out now in your country with this huge bailout and all this rescue of the banks, and all these forces that are playing out in Europe as a reaction of this huge crisis in the U.S. are the same forces that created my city, are the same things that created this massive migration. Of course, with the complicity of my government. But I think it's not something just, it's not a problem from the politicians in Mercedes and Mercedes. It's also something that is concerning you.
There's a picture I want to, one of the images in the book, and I'm going to check, you know this, obviously. Describe this for us, if you would. I want to talk about this.
Acres and acres of my desert in Arizona, covered with thrown away panties, brassieres, trousers, blouses, day packs, shoes, cosmetics, empty food cans. And what it is what you call it's a dump site, it's a drop point. That picture is taken 40 miles north of the border. Mexicans have walked several days to get there. They're met by vans. The vans have clothing bought at a Walmart or that, so that when these people strip naked as fast as possible, get on these new clothings, they get in the van. Then they're taken to a stash house in my city, Tucson. Then they're shipped around the United States. But what you're looking at there is a Statue of Liberty. What you're looking at there is Ellis Island. What you're looking at is where millions of new Americans enter the United States. This is what their children will see, that photograph. Now, your listeners are probably saying these people should wait and enter legally. I'm hardly in favor of laws, except the ones I break. Now, I do take issue with the Internal Revenue Service. But if the average Mexican says, I'll go down to the U.S. consulate and get a permit and enter legally, he'd better take good care of himself because he's going to be 100 years old before that form comes back. I mean, there is no choice. You either come illegally or you don't come. And everybody, drunk or sober, knows that. So that's not an option.
Yeah. Julian, do you want to say something about this image? Was it it just seems to the scale of it is so impressive.
The site's much larger than the photo.
Yeah.
But, you know.
We'd
have to have a big book for the site.
You want to say something about that?
Well, it's impressive to be there in one of those places and to see all the details hidden in the photograph. I think there are some personal stories that I think there are millions of personal stories hidden in pictures like this. The real stories of the people, their families. Chuck was collecting some documents from the trash, and they tell us very hard stories. And I like to hear Chuck about one or two stories about what he found on this on this place.
It was full of stories.
Well, it's kind of like El Pastor's story, meaning these people are afraid. They know very little about the United States except American television. Forgive me, El Pastor. God help them. I go through one of these day packs. I find some kid from central Mexico, the state of Hidalgo, that's brought his elementary school records, proving he's taking these classes in Spanish, you know.
And English.
Yeah, not English. Because he thinks, well, you know, I get to the United States. If I show this to somebody, maybe they'll give me a job, prove I'm a good guy. I find a letter in there, obviously written in a child's hand, 7 or 8 year old, probably a girl. You can just tell, you know. Frankly, because you can read it. If a 7 or 8 year old boy wrote it, it would be hopeless. And says, "Dear Dad, I'm so sorry you have to go to the United States for that nice job, but I'm so glad you're flying in an airplane. Please remember me and be careful and come back soon." And what it is this guy's left it when he shed his clothing. He's obviously carried it through murderous heat because it meant something. He's lied to a 7 or 8 year old girl. There is no airplane. He's walking through a deadly desert surrounded by bandits so he can feed her so she can stay 7 or 8 years old and think her dad flies on an airplane and be innocent. And so you go through there. You know, I felt dirty going through these things, but I'm a reporter. Like, I had no right to know this, and yet here I'm telling people on this radio. There's things you have to know. As I told you earlier, you have a perfect right to be against illegal immigration or be in favor of it. But you have to face the fact these are people just like we are, with the same needs, the same fears, and the same dreams.
And there's another...
And they can cook pretty good, too, I want to tell you that.
There's another part of this story about this photograph. I think there are many things hidden here. One is the human tragedy for our country, for our failed economy, for our failed political system. But there are also... You can see brand names on it because these people are going to work for American places, Burger King. They are going to work for the maybe Hilton hotels. They are going to work to Italian restaurants. You can deduce that they are going to those places. You can see this field of dreams, and the dreams are in the form of American brands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, hey, look, I'll shut up in a second. This photograph is the underbelly of that huge phrase, the global economy. This is the back room we don't want to face.
Chuck, I want to have you read another section from the book. This is from page 105. This is sort of, as you describe it in the book, this is the basic script.
What is it, 105? Okay. This one.
Yeah.
I'll do it. You have entered a middle passage, and it ends at the stash house. In between that bus from the interior you disembarked from in Altar, Sonora, and the stash house in Tucson or Phoenix, almost anyone could rob you or kill you or rape you, and many will try. At the moment, you're worth a few $100, almost like an oil future. But you must get to the stash house before you are worth real money and worth protecting. And you must do it by force of will. In this sector of the line, the 300-mile-wide Tucson sector, 400 or 500 of you will die, most in the summer. Others will die and rot in the desert and go uncounted. A year ago, a woman from Zacatecas went down and died in late June. Her father came up and searched for weeks to find her body in the desert, a valley of several hundred square miles. In his quest, he stumbled on two other corpses before finding the remains of his own child. At dusk on the line, you'll go through the wire with 20, 30 or more Mexicans. There'll be a guide. You'll carry a gallon of water and that black day pack. The temperatures in summer could be 110 or 115 degrees during the day. You'll walk anywhere from 10 to 60 miles, depending on the route and what you've agreed to pay. There will be rattlesnakes, cactus, and trees. Almost no sign of people or their homes. Everything will have thorns and rake your skin as you stumble through the darkness. You will keep up or you'll be left behind. If you're a woman, you have a fair chance of being raped. And you will most likely never speak of these nights again so long as you live. You will have children and grandchildren, and you'll teach them many, many things. But if you're like the others who have passed this way, these nights will remain your secret. A major strand of the largest known human migration on Earth is passing through this section of the Arizona desert day and night in silence. No one is really counting the people. Nobody's really recording their journeys. They are items on the back pages of border newspapers. Their Ellis Island is not marked on the map. Somewhere between Altar, Sonora, and Tucson and Phoenix, Arizona, new Americans are being made, and their souls are being forged in a burning desert. Soon, they and their descendants will number 30 million, and this vast silence is likely to be the savage part of their repressed history.
Charles Bowden, he is a writer and reporter, Julian Cardona, a photojournalist. The book is called Exodus. We should say that tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, they're going to be at Ken Sanders Rare Books for a release party and a book signing. There's also going to be a display of some of Cardona's images, and the event is free. To learn more about it, go to our website, KUER.org/Radio West. Charles Bowden, Julian Cardona, thank you very much for being with
thank
us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
And El Pastor,
thank you very much.
Come on down. We'll have us a time.
Great. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.